Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to the show. Welcome to another episode that cannot be stopped. Maybe it's unstoppable, if you will. This is Action Movie Anatomy, episode 87. Tony Scott's brilliant magnus opus, Unstoppable. We'll see you in just 1 second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! Yes!
Aw, yeah.
Oh, my God. This song just puts me in... It's just sex.
This is what Denzel's alarm clock is. This is when he just gets out of bed. He's like, all right, here we go. Here we go.
It's gotta be.
It's gotta be.
Then it, like, turns off, and he's like, all right. Then he, like, turns on the shower, and it starts playing again. He's got it rigged to every appliance and switch in his house. He, like, puts toaster, and it, like, starts playing again.
Yeah. Damn it, I hate that song. Yes, dude, it's the last one.
Oh, it's, like, such a bittersweet moment.
It really is.
All right, guys, this is Action Movie Anatomy. We cover action movies on this show. This is the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated... I'm just too excited. Dedicated to talking movies and all things movie-related. I'm your host, Ben Bateman. This is my co-host, Mr. Andrew Guy.
What's up, everybody? I'm here. Thank you for the golf clap. You're right. Bittersweet is the best way to describe it, man. I mean, it was one of those things where it's like, we have to do it eventually, but as soon as we do, it's just done.
Yeah, so I want to get right into it, guys. If you want to follow along with the conversation on the show, the podcast itself is on Twitter, at AMA Podcast. It's a good Twitter. People have been very interactive with us.
Yeah.
You can find us personally at Ben Bateman Media.
And you can find me at Andrew Guy.
And, yeah, we talk about action movies on this show. Those movies adhere to four basic rules. Number one, the hero always plays by their own rules. Yeah, totally, absolutely.
Any movie Denzel's in.
Yeah, any movie Denzel's in. Rule number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room. I mean, I guess to some degree the train is the villain, and that makes, because it's unstoppable, it is the smartest thing. Like, Denzel is the smartest guy in the room, and the train is, like, outsmarting him by, like, being unstoppable.
Yeah, and, like...
that's a really weak villain description.
Yeah, it really is, like, outsmarting the entire... I just want to say MTA, because it just reminds me of Taken.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just give that a loose yes.
Movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure.
Or you can work for the man or... Yeah, that's
yeah, political. Like, you can work for the man or be the man.
Exactly. And so that's literally was just created for Denzel and Taking.
Yeah, and so it works again in this one, which is great. And rule number four, there's a minimum of one explosion. There's definitely at least one explosion in every Tony Scott movie.
Absolutely.
That's like a hallmark of Tony Scott. The rich man's Michael Bay.
Absolutely. And, God, it's my favorite thing about Tony Scott movies with Man on Fire and Taking and Deja and Unstoppable is literally as soon as the production companies are done being listed, it's just like grainy shot, sound.
He's officially entered his green period during this. Yes.
Yeah.
Guys, we're going to get just straight into this. The reason this is relevant, for those of you listening or watching, maybe you're thinking to yourselves, why the fuck are you guys doing Unstoppable? What's relevant about that movie?
Fair question to ask.
So, Tony Scott, the younger brother of Ridley Scott, did five movies with Denzel Washington. Those five movies are Crimson Tide. He came back together with him 10 years later for Man on Fire in 2004. Mm-hmm. Deja Vu in 2007. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 in 2009. And finally, Unstoppable in 2010. There is some quality to those movies that Andrew and I have come to love during this show. There's an appreciation for the man that is Tony Scott that we never knew we had. And I have to say, aside from, like, just the development of the Tom Cruise obsession that this show has like, birthed us, that's the other most distinctive characteristic of the show for me.
Oh, 100%. I don't think there's any other... No, it's either Tom Cruise or Denzel and Tony. Those are our only two things that we nerd out about the most.
And watching this movie will remind... If you watch this show, and then you want to go revisit the catalog, and this movie especially, because this is... And we'll get to why this movie is relevant... This is a prime example of their movie making together. It's such a simple movie. So we're going to get straight into it, guys. We're going to start, before we show you the trailer, with something we call the name game. Now, this is a good one because this movie is called Unstoppable. It's about a train that cannot be stopped. Hence the title. Unstoppable. Andrew and I were both tasked with the challenge of coming up with a better name than Unstoppable, the name game. And there isn't one. This movie, nothing happens in this movie aside from a train on a track that's going really fast and these two guys that are, like, developing a mutual respect.
Yeah.
which is like a common theme, I think, in, at least in the two Train movies.
It's funny because we usually like to do this for movies. Or first of all, let's do this real quick. Happy birthday, James Finneran. I know you're a big fan of ours.
Ah, happy birthday, James.
Yeah, that's cool. He just said it's his birthday and he's watching his favorite show. And then we got Bassist, who was just listening to Still Dre.
Okay.
And then we got Joel Hammett, who was like, why are they doing this movie? Which is perfect that we're talking about it right now. Anyways, what I was saying is that we like to do the name game for movies with like very generic names like John Wick or Jack Reacher or Unstoppable.
Right.
But we've also found out that it's fucking hard to come up with a creative name, and like Unstoppable is really the best name for this movie. I was like, The Tracks of Destiny or a missile on the train.
Yeah, right.
You know?
The Chrysler Building or something.
Yeah. Well, do you have any good names?
The ones that came to mind for me were like Collision Course or like Broken Track,
but
or no. Yeah, it's not even broken. Or like Tracks of Peril,
The Tracks of Destiny.
The one that kept coming to mind for me was something about the destination, like Destination Destruction,
Final Destination.
Yeah, right. Something
that's
like
good.
That. Something like that.
I was trying to think of something like with the two of their relationship forming, but
right. Yeah, I don't know.
It's hard. It's harder than you guys think. I think the real reason we even... Because we sat down, I was like, I can't think of a name. Should we just cut it? And you're like, no, I think it's a good thing to talk about. So you guys, we're looking to you. Throw some names at us in the live chat. And if you guys think of a great... Speed 3, that's a great name.
Yeah, exactly. The Taking of Pelham 124.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just fun, short, stupid. That's the name game. I can't think of any. I want to do something with like Thomas the Tank Engine, but that's just reaching really far.
Yeah, I mean something like, you know, Blood on the Tracks or
but no blood is on.
Yeah.
Oh, Marissa, yeah, we got Marissa Serafini up in the booth, everybody. I don't know why I point up because she's not up there.
She's not above us. She's
over there
in the sky right now.
Marissa, do you have a name for Unstoppable that you could think of?
Not right now.
See?
I'll try to think of
it's
one.
Very hard. Very difficult.
So before we get into thesis statement, guys, let's cue the trailer and just get a sense. I think this is a prime trailer. It's like,
yeah.
I don't think it's like that it's the best trailer, but it's like prime in the sense that it's just very representative of the time and the kind of movie this is.
And who's in it.
Yeah, big time.
All right.
All right, then. Okay.
Okay.
I'm Wolf Coulson. We're working together today. Train 1206.
Is there a problem?
I just don't like working at a damn daycare center.
I don't like working at a retirement home, so.
Oh. All right. All right.
All right,
this
then.
This ain't training. In training, they just give you an F. Out here, you get killed.
Makes being a train conductor sound super intense.
How about you? You married?
Got two beautiful daughters.
Got two beautiful daughters. Yeah.
Have fun.
What do we do when we get to a railroad crossing?
Of course, Denzel has two beautiful daughters.
Of course, he always has two beautiful daughters. Wife died of cancer.
We have an unmanned train rolling into a highly populated area with no air brakes.
Yeah.
106, 106.
What's up?
There's an unmanned train on the northbound track.
It's under power?
It's coming straight at us.
What are we worried about in terms of cargo?
Eight freight cars of hazardous chemicals. We're not just talking about a train.
We're talking about a missile.
We're talking about a missile the size of the Chrysler Building.
Nice, Rosario.
You know where the train is. We're not
exactly sure. I kind of love sure. Rosario
we'll
Dawson.
Out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It gets worse.
I met her before.
I've got 150
really?
Students coming in on some
field. She's stunning in real life.
16.
She's very pretty.
Yeah.
Train that size going that fast. Vaporize anything in front of it.
We have been told to anticipate an event radius 20 to 45 miles.
The only way to stop that kind of power.
Grab it
by
the tail.
Gun in the opposite direction.
And you're just the man for the job,
you
Denzel.
You want to kill yourself, you do it alone.
All right, you do what you want.
All right.
Wait. I'm not risking this company just because some engineer wants to play hero.
This trailer makes trains look like terrorists.
Yeah.
Crimson Train.
That's good.
That's good. We're gonna run
this trailer makes trains look like terrorists. Who said that?
Joel Hammett.
That's pretty good, Joel. That's pretty good.
Name game. Emotional reaction.
Tell your sister I love you both.
The train is increasing in speed.
I love that they're shooting
nuclear
at it.
Cargo. Unstoppable.
Unstoppable. Close your eyes if you want.
You got a real knack for inspiring confidence, you know that?
Unbelievable. Oh my god.
Man.
I'm so sad he's gone. I'm just so fucking sad he's gone.
Me too. I wonder how many more amazing Tony Scott, Denzel movies with Rosario Dawson showing up there would have been.
And Kevin Dunn or his clone.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Rispoli, who's...
Yep. Yeah, he loves Michael Rispoli. Yeah. I'm just bummed about it. I was just going to keep saying the same thing over and over. I don't need to do that.
Yep. All right, so guys, we are going to get into thesis statement. So thesis statement is your bold thought on the movie, the thing that you try to share as kind of your party trick. This is what I know about this movie. It's your strongest idea, your boldest thought, should be almost like rooted in hyperbole, and we're going to share ours now. So we're a little handicapped on this one because it's hard for all of our ideas not to circle back to what we sort of opened the show with, which is that we have come to appreciate and like characterize the Tony Scott Denzel thing in a way that it's not like that's common knowledge. It's not like people talk about, you know, some directors will sort of be in the consensus top 10 of all time, or, you know, Tom Cruise is kind of one of the best few action stars in most people's minds ever.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, and Denzel's, you know, one of the great, most popular leading men ever. But the combination of Tony Scott and Denzel being something relevant is
people
not something
talk about that.
You hear.
Yesterday, on my way to rehearsal, I was sitting in the car with my teammates, and we were talking. I was just thinking about the show because I just finished watching Unstoppable.
Yeah.
And so I'd been like, "Hey, Jack, have you seen Unstoppable?" He's like, "That's a train one, right?" I was like, yeah. What do you think about it? And we kind of talked a little bit and with the driver. And I was like, the reason that we're doing it on the show is because Ben and I, we love the collaboration of Tony Scott and Denzel. And he's like, "Really?" And I went on this like 15-minute tangent about all the movies they'd been in, and... I kid you not, I say all this and Jack's like, "Wow, that's a really good point." And the driver just cuts him off and goes, "Holy fuck, you know your movies."
Yeah.
He just turns and looks at me like this wide eyed. I was like, "Yeah, man." And he's like, "I need to go watch all of those movies."
Yeah.
He's like, "Start with Man on Fire. It's my favorite." Yeah.
I think, I don't know.
You like Crimson?
We've ranked them before. I think we ranked them on the Deja Vu episode. I actually have my moments when I love each one of them the most.
They're all great for such different reasons. And like Taking a Pelham, as much as I don't like that movie for the show, and as much as I kind of shit on it,
made a career it on the making show, fun of it.
There's a couple of moments in that film that are so great that are better than almost any.
Yeah,
like that. The moments in that film are just as good as any moment in any of the other Denzel Tony Scott films.
Yeah. I think there's like a moment and a thing about each movie that makes me want to watch them again.
Mm-hmm.
They always kind of come back around for me. And now, like, sort of noticing all the things that he does, I feel that way more and more. So, my thesis statement is going to be this: Unstoppable is the simplest, cleanest, and ultimately least necessary but most representative movie Tony Scott made with Denzel. Fitting that it's the last movie that they made together.
Yeah.
And when I say that, what I mean is, if you think about the five movies they made, this one has the least happening. It's the least going on.
There's, it's literally like, you know, point A to point B.
There's not
line.
Even a villain. The villain's a train.
Yeah.
It's basically just all the hallmarks. It's Denzel at his most movie starish, just like...
Just living in it.
Being a movie star. You even Chris Pine is kind of like... Could be anybody. Like, he's fine. He's totally good in this. Like, I think he does a good job. There's so little pretense with this movie. All of the other characters, these sort of like caricatures of bureaucratic fill-ins, you know, the yard operator, you know, Kevin Dunn playing, you know, this Galvin, who's this totally irrelevant villain. Like, none of them matter. They're there to like basically punctuate and further the plot. For just Denzel.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if Kevin Dunn was not in the film, there would still be a runaway train that needed to be stopped.
And it wouldn't be Kevin Dunn, it would be Michael Rispoli.
Yeah,
or it would be John Turturro, or it would be...
Just someone that thinks that what you're doing is dumb. There's always that guy
that
just kind of shits on what you're doing, and he's smarter. So I have a couple thesis statements. I have my original one that I've been saying for a year and a half, and that's that you cannot have a great action movie without a great villain.
Yep.
And I think this is a good action movie. I think it's fun. I like it. It is not a great action movie, and I think most people can agree with that. But what I did want to say is that what's the great... Or like, my other thesis I was kind of thinking about is that, is there a better actor-director combo out there? There's like... Leo and Scorsese is like famous. That's a big
one.
And De Niro and Scorsese. So those are the two big ones. And then like, you know, what other... Like, who does Cameron have? It was Hamilton for a minute.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, or
Bill Paxton.
Paxton.
Right, he shows up like in all of the movies. I mean, if you're looking for like leading man combos, I mean, yeah, or you could...
Fuqua has used Denzel twice now.
Yeah, three times, right?
Two? What's the middle one? Because I know there's Mag 7 and Training Day.
And Equalizer.
And Equalizer, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's a hard one. I think when you're trying to come up with like the leading man combo, I think that's a little harder to come up with. I think it's easy to say, you know, PT used PSH,
yeah,
Philip Seymour Hoffman in a pretty remarkable way. What, three times? Four times. He's got a small role in Sydney. Then he's obviously great in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
He's got a great role in Magnolia.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a great role in Punch Drunk Love.
Oh,
he's got a great role.
He's
great in The Master.
Yeah, he's very good in The Master.
So, I mean, he definitely used him a lot.
That is a very good... PT and PSH might be better, because I like both of them more.
But I agree with you. I mean, in terms of, like, a guy that could sort of get what he wanted in the right way out of a movie star,
yeah,
that's a thing that's hard to do. And, you know, we're gonna talk about the moments here in a second, but... Mm-hmm. So there's a writer online named Jesse, and he wrote an article for the AV Club. You can find Jesse at Rock Marooned. And it's this great article talking about Tony Scott and Denzel. And he writes articles about directors that have worked with actors three times or more.
Okay.
So if there's a collaboration three times, he'll write an article. And so this one was about Scott and Denzel. And I thought it was really interesting. What he kind of said was that since Training Day, since the Oscar... Denzel's kind of made all these movies. He's attempted to get Oscars. He's gotten a couple nominations in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that ultimately, the best moments in that time have come from movies that either were Tony Scott Denzel movies or felt like they should have been Tony Scott Denzel movies.
Which is like, what, the Fuquas and the Qs?
He basically suggests the Equalizer just should have been a Tony Scott movie.
Absolutely should be.
Magnificent Seven really could have and should have just been a Tony Scott movie.
It would have been so crazy to see him do a Western.
Yeah, but like, so the quote that I pulled from his article here is, one major difference between Scott and other directors who have worked repeatedly with Washington, including Spike Lee, Antoine Fuqua, and Ed Zwick, is that Washington never won or was nominated for an Oscar in any Tony Scott movies. Their work together is unabashed, unembarrassed, if occasionally self-serious pulp with no real pretense of actorly grandeur. And that's so fucking true. That's the best part about these movies.
Exactly. It's because Denzel is just existing.
Yeah, you don't watch being like, God, Denzel is going to... Hell of a performance by Denzel in this movie. It's a hell of a movie star performance.
Yeah.
You know? And they're all... He puts... That's the other thing I was thinking about Tony Scott is that every one of these movies, even though Tony Scott didn't direct Out of Time, mm-hmm. could just be called Out of Time.
Yeah.
Every fucking movie they make together, we're running out of time to determine whether or not the launch codes need to be activated so we can blow up the Russians. We're running out of time to save Dakota Fanning. Let's put the time of day on the screen. We're running out of time because in 4 days, Paula Patton's going to get murdered with this time machine thing. We're running out of time because this hostage negotiation with this crazy guy trying to hike is going to kill people. We're running out of time because this train's going to blow up a city. Like,
that's crazy.
They could just be called
Out of Time.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Yeah. And if you think about it, it's like a lot of the movies that he made during that time. I mean, the movie Out of Time, obviously. John Q, he's running out of time. Like, it's just sort of like he just put himself in this period of his career where like he was just content making these movies that were these sort of like action man of action the
Must
man of action
been so fun for him that I mean because so like the Denzel roles that like really blow you away that people talk about, it's like it's almost too Denzel-y now, you know what I mean? Like when you go back and you watch Training Day,
yeah,
it is a little too Denzel-y.
Yeah, the Denzelishness is off the charts.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
but I mean if you love him as much as we do, it's fantastic. But what's so great about these is that he is so nonchalant and casual about being Denzel. And he just slips it in. Like, my favorite line is my favorite line because Denzel says it. It's like only Denzel could get away with saying that line.
Yeah.
And I would sit there and be like, man, that's great.
You know? Yeah, there's just something about it. So what we've decided to come up with here was we believe that the Tony Scott-Denzel Washington combination results in one or more of these perfect moments.
Yeah.
These... I love it. I love it when Jesse says here in the article, if occasionally self-serious pulp, because they are self-serious, but if you just abandon your pretense, you can appreciate the fact that these moments are what make these movies more than what they appear to be, which is just kind of surface-level action movies.
Yeah, and you know what? That's an excellent thesis as well, is that every Tony Scott Denzel movie has a moment in it that legitimizes it. It makes it worth appreciating, not watching, appreciating.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's a really cool thing for us to talk about. So let's go in and we'll go chronologic here. We'll start with Crimson Tide.
So Crimson Tide is great. We've done the episode on the show before.
Yeah, and you actually had basically introduced this movie to me. I'd watched it once, maybe 15 years ago, and the scene where Denzel is refusing to give up control and taking over over Gene Hackman. What is it that he says? What is he doing there?
He's they're arguing and Hackman's like, you know, they're fueling their missiles. We got, and Denzel looks at him and he's like, Captain Ramsey, under operating procedures governing the release of nuclear weapons, we cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Both you and I agree.
And it's just like, you're just like, yes! Yeah. Like, you fucking got this, because we know you're right, because we know he's a cowboy.
On your side.
We know he's crazy. And then they argue some more about arresting him, and he's like, and then Cobb is like, Captain, the XO's right. And it's just, that whole scene is so great.
That look that Gene gives him after he's like, he's right. He's just like, oh, it looks like a kill, man.
This is the only one of the five movies. There's two major differences in Crimson Tide and the other four. One, Denzel was still in like prime physical shape. So he sort of resembles a leading man in the traditional sense of the word, with like muscles and abs in a way that he doesn't later in his career.
Yeah.
Tony Scott like revives him as much more of like an everyman type. But in this one, he is a much more, but at the same time, he's overshadowed in this movie by Gene Hackman.
I was just going to say, it's the only movie where, in this list that we're talking about, where he's not the main guy. Like, he is, but Gene, I mean, he's Gene Hackman.
Right.
You know, they're going to go toe-to-toe the whole movie.
And Hackman's going to get top billing at that point.
Yeah, of course.
You know? Denzel at that point's only won a supporting actor Oscar for Glory. Mm-hmm. You know, Hackman's...
He's been running it for, like, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
Or 15, something like that?
Yeah, long time. So that's definitely the Crimson Tide moment, though there are some other great ones. The next one, Man on Fire.
Yeah.
The final 8-9 minutes of that movie is so good.
It is so heartbreaking and beautiful. And it's because of the relationship between him and Dakota Fanning. So I'm going to preface this with my moment, which is a little different than what you're going to talk about here, because this is like our moment where it's just like you can't fight it. But it's when they're sitting there and they're doing the blocks.
Yep.
And you're watching this movie, and the only reason that movie is even close to as good as it is because Dakota Fanning and his relationship is perfect and completely believable. So the whole swimming analogy that they use and the metaphor and working with it the whole time, that leads to this very last moment of when they finally get the trade done and he gets to see her for the last time. So let's break this down.
Well, the whole sequence is great because you have Rada Mitchell, who's back in the car, and she's got the brother.
Freaking out.
And she's freaking out. She's got, like, the shotgun. And Denzel says something to her like, you know, if anything goes wrong, you kill him right here and drive away. And on the other side, you've got this family, this crime family, who's holding Dakota Fanning, and you know, they're basically like, this fucker's killed so many of our people. We'll give the girl back. We can get him and torture him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great because their relationship is built so well. So he gets to the bridge, and they let Dakota Fanning go, and she runs like a little kid. You know, she's got a little girl run. She runs towards him. At this point, we know Denzel's been shot. So
and he's You don't know if it's fatal or not, but he's struggling.
Yeah, he looks like he's almost dead already. Mm-hmm. He's kind of really stumbling along. And he sees Dakota Fanning, and she runs up, and, you know, she hugs him. And it's already really emotional. It's like a very emotional moment. And she's like, he's like, they didn't hurt you. And then she says to him, he's like, you're going home. And she goes, where are you going, crazy? And he's like, I'm going home, too. I'm going to the Blue Bayou.
The Blue Bayou. Chills right now.
Yeah, I'm going to the Blue Bayou. And she looks at him, and she's like, I love you, crazy. Do you love me too? And he's kind of quietly like, I love you. You know I do, more than anything. And then she runs back, and he walks slowly, and he puts his hand up on his chest, and he sees the red dot laser on his hand. And like that whole little sequence of them on the bridge, the 2 minutes there, is like, it's like everything that's great about that movie.
Yeah.
The payoff is fucking beautiful.
It really is. And it really, guys, go watch our Man on Fire episode.
Yeah.
Go watch the movie and go watch the Man on Fire episode because you will love it.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. As we continue moving.
Okay.
So Deja Vu.
This one's a little tougher.
Yeah. This one's weird. So Deja Vu, you know that Deja Vu doesn't have a scene, like a standout scene, really, in the vein that we're talking about. Because if you look it up on YouTube, there's just one scene that gets played over and over again, everybody clips. And that's the only scene you can find. And it's the scene when they're in the control room. And he basically realizes that they're looking into the past.
Yeah.
And he shows the laser through, and it blows the whole thing and shorts the whole system. And he's very Denzel. He's kind of stuttering as he says it. But I don't think that's the scene. I think the scene in this movie, there's a few where the Denzelishness really shines through. Denzelishness, by the way, it's stolen from the the Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time period podcast.
Yes.
Kevin Avery and W. Kamau Bell. Great podcast. But I think it's the scene when he meets Paula Patton's dad. It's not even a Denzel moment.
No, it's not. And he actually doesn't really even say anything. Yeah. It's just what the dad says.
The dad's like, take these pictures of her, of Claire.
He's like, I already got some.
Claire Kutrover.
Or something. He said.
And he's like, no, that's not necessary. And he says, no, Officer Carlin, she has to matter to you. I know how these things work.
She has to matter to you.
She has to matter to you. And there's just like, that's the moment in the movie where you're like, oh, that's like a really fucking real moment. That's like,
it's again, it's what we were just talking about. There's that like just a sliver, just a little taste of like something that's just it really hits you. And that moment when it's said in the movie, you almost don't want to let it affect you because it feels almost cheap. But then you realize you're like, no, man, that's a dad.
Yeah.
Being like, no, this is my daughter.
Yeah.
Not just another person you're looking for.
Totally.
And then there's also the moments of Denzel falling in love with Paula Patton through the screen, which is also, it's just so hard to kind of like put into one scene.
Yeah, agreed. You know? I mean, that would be, those scenes would be the scenes we're really talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those are definitely the moments. But I think that one represents kind of
what we're talking
about.
The
feeling. The next one is in the Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, and this is the one we've talked about the absolute most on the show.
So I got to do the other one because we're not going to talk about that because however it is so good.
Yeah.
This one's better. So the one that I'm going to reference is at the very end.
Yeah.
When she's like, well, you need to get a gallon of milk.
Yeah.
He's like, I can get a half gallon. I can't get a whole gallon. Yeah. She's like, I want a gallon of milk. He's like, all right. What does he say at the very end?
Well, he's on the phone and he's like, if I don't, you know, he says, if I don't come home, you know, tell her to run straight at the hurdles. You tell her to run straight at the hurdles. And she's like, well, you tell her yourself,
because
we need milk. So you bring home a gallon. He's like,
A gallon?
I can bring home a half gallon. I can bring home a half gallon.
And, like, you don't know why it's a great line, but it's like they're saying so much about their relationship with that little thing. It's like, we need you.
Those are the moments, though, where I think about the whole process of one of these Tony Scott movies getting made, everything from script to picture. And I think about a worse director lets that scene get cut or lets it get cut from the script because he doesn't think it matters, or he makes it more obvious and tries to heavy-hand it into just like, you tell our daughters I love them.
Yeah,
okay, honey, you know, I love you.
I hope you make it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's like, you tell yourself. It's like, that is who Denzel would be married to.
Yeah, right. And it's just something great about it. So that's the one.
That's the one that I love, but the other one.
The other one is, and this is, if you look up Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 on YouTube, it'll just be listed as the Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 intense scene.
Yeah, I think that if we were trying to put this whole thing that we're talking about, like this whole segment into one moment to describe it, it's this scene.
Agreed. So it's So Denzel's having this argument with John Travolta, who plays Ryder, and Travolta has now figured out that Denzel was part of this whole scandal where he lost his job and was demoted. Basically, they're arguing, and he's like, "Tell me how you fucking did it." And he's like, and Denzel's like, "I didn't do it.
I didn't do it."
Yeah, and he's like, "If you don't fucking do it, I'm gonna kill this kid." And so then Denzel's like, "Fine,
all right, slow down."
And he's like, "I took a bribe." And everybody's listening on the radio, and everybody, they do this great thing where they flash around the station for a second.
Mm-hmm.
They show this older guy with glasses who, just the one look that he gives, it suggests like, he's probably somebody who's worked with Denzel for a long time who probably really believed him.
Yeah.
And then Denzel's saying now that he took the bribe, and the guy's kind of having this moment of like, really? You're guilty? I took the bribe.
Yeah.
I took the bribe. And then he's like, tell me how you did it. And Denzel, so many things about the moment are so indicative of his characters in these movies. You know, he's like, I took $30,000. I used the money to put my kids through college, okay? I have two kids. And you're like, of course you have two kids.
Of course you have two kids. You're Denzel Washington in a movie.
You have two beautiful daughters, probably.
Yeah.
And of course you use the money to put them through college because it's incredibly noble. And you stole this money to put your kids... And you're so embarrassed and you're crying.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing it to save this kid's life because you're the fucking most noble...
You're a goddamn hero, Garber.
You're a goddamn... Yeah, that's the fucking greatest moment is that Travolta's still holding the gun to the kid. And he's like, tell Officer Garber, thank you. He's like, thank you, Officer Garber. And he's like, Garber, you're my goddamn hero, man.
Yeah,
and you're like, everything about it is so heavy-handed and so pulpy, but fucking good.
Perfect. It literally is just enough. And then when that scene ends, you're just like, I'm in.
Yeah.
I am on board with Denzel. All right. So the last one.
Yeah. And this, I think what we should do is, because this segues directly into Fist Pump moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Did I just skip fist pump moment?
Yeah, we just, but it's good because we're gonna we can use our fist pump for this.
All right, it's just not registering because it's poorly printed. So yeah, this is, I mean, the reason that we do this is basically to replace fist pump moment because this movie unfortunately doesn't have as many like obvious fist pumps.
No,
except for this one. And this is the moment in the movie.
It's the perfect moment. It's the Tony Scott, Denzel moment.
It's another fucking phone call.
Where you find out that this guy is being way more noble than he needs to be. He's like, what is his name in this movie? I just totally blanked it.
Galvin or...
Garvin? Galvin.
Galvin is... That's Kevin Dunn.
What's Denzel's name?
Oh,
why did I just blank it?
I don't know. Jack? Frank?
Frank. He's like, if you do that, you're fired. I will fire you. He's like... You already did. What?
Yeah.
It's like, you already fired me.
Yeah.
It's like, I got my 90-day notice 72 days ago.
Yeah.
It's like, you already fired me. Forced early retirement with half benefits.
Half benefits. You're like, oh, God, that company's going to fuck him. Like, God, come on, guys. He's Denzel. What are you doing? And you're like, he's got this yellow vest over here. He's got this rookie who's coming in. Will Coulson taking his job. And Kevin Dunn's like, he's like, so you're telling me you're going to risk your life with 3 weeks left, what, you know? And he's like, "I'm not doing it for you."
I'm doing it for you, yeah.
And you're like, "God damn right, you're not doing it for him."
Just doing it.
And then, of course, Will Coulson, he gets fucking inspired, and he's like, "Coulson, if you don't, stop this train, I will fire you. I will fire you." And he's like, "You're gonna have to fire me." And then he's like,
"God damn it, did you hear what I just said?"
He's like, "This is your conductor, Will Coulson. We're going to run this bitch down." You're like,
That is the fist pump, which is also the great Tony Denzel moment.
Yeah, of course.
The Tony Washington, the Denzel Scott moment.
It's everything that's great about him. I did the premiere for Taboo, the new FX show, about 2 weeks ago, and Ridley Scott's a producer on the show, and honest to God, I was really hoping that Ridley was going to be on that carpet because I would have shaken his hand and I would have said, I'm a huge fan of your movies. I want you to know I miss your brother's work more than almost any director I can think of. And I am such a fan, and I just wanted to let you know that his work has really affected me. And I'm sure you miss him 100 times more than I could ever understand, but I just want to let you know. He made action movies, and I'm an action movie fan, and I fucking loved his work.
Yeah, I would love to say something along the same lines, because Tony Scott is one of the most underappreciated directors of our generation.
Ever.
Yeah. And it's because he did these movies that are kind of throwaway popcorn flicks that people kind of just brush under the rug. But it's these moments that we just talked about. It's those things that it's so hard to find. It's so hard to recreate. And so, Tony, RIP, my brother.
So that's the consensus fist pump for the both of us?
Easy, right?
I don't think there's any question on that one. So let's move through the show, guys. Let's get into a little bit of star profiles, where the guys were in their careers, when this film was made. Interesting places.
Yeah, it's so weird. So Denzel, you've got, in 2007, he did The Great Debaters, which he got a Golden Globe nomination.
Maybe, yeah, he directed it as well, I believe.
Maybe, yeah. I think it got nominated for Best Picture at the Golden Globes as well, but I can't remember. Then you got Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, and then you got The Book of Eli. The Book of Eli is just atrocious for me. Yeah. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen. I think it was because I was so excited to see Denzel again. It'd been a while. But he's done. Like, he's done gunning for Oscars. Now he's in that phase what we're talking about, where he's just kind of the everyman action hero that just does things that he wants to do.
Yeah, and I think this is really the end of that phase, because flash forward 2 or 3 years and you have a movie like Two Guns, which just kind of completely gets ignored. No one really watches. You have a movie like Safe House.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That reminds me. Guys, fans out there, if you're in the live chat and you've seen Safe House, just throw your thoughts on it real quick. Because Ben and I have been wondering about that movie for a long time.
Yeah. Neither of us have ever taken the time to watch it. But yeah, and even when you get to The Equalizer, which is really entertaining, and I like The Equalizer a lot, it's also a movie that was like released and promoted kind of in the same way that like John Wick was, where it's an original concept. I think it's based on a television show, but it didn't come out and like people didn't see it. It was basically a Netflix movie.
It needed to be a Tony Scott movie.
It was basically a Netflix movie, and I think to some degree his, you know, Denzel's brand has degraded a little bit from the point that it was in the 2000s because he's a little older. It's a younger generation. But I think that this kind of marks the end of that run. Like, it's basically Training Day in 01, and then the whole next decade is just these, like, man-of-action, big-budget movies. Because Flight is, like, 2015.
Flight is so good. That's, like, classic Denzel.
And he's going to win the Oscar this year for Fences.
Yeah, you're sure of it? You think so?
Yeah, pretty positive.
Seems pretty strong.
So now he's in that phase that we always like to talk about, which is like the next 10 years probably he's not going to be playing the man of action roles.
Yeah.
You know, he was just in Magnificent Seven, but that to me feels like it's about as I don't think we're going to see many more. You know, Equalizer 2 comes out probably this year.
Isn't that awesome? And the thing about Equalizer is it's a very different type of action hero than he's been. He's like very older.
Yeah.
Very methodical, and it's because he's so well trained that he can still be one. It's not because he's like a badass fighter. It's because he's like, he's perfect when it comes to fighting. But what I was going to say is that Denzel's in that phase of his career that we want so many of our favorite actors to get to.
Yeah, right.
That like noble old man where you can be like a grizzled savage, you know? Like,
yeah.
We want Tom Cruise to get there so bad. I wanted PSH to get there so badly. But Denzel's, what is he, like 62?
62, about. Yeah. 61, 62, yeah.
And obviously he still looks great. So he can play anywhere from early 50s to like, I bet if with makeup in his 70s.
Yeah.
But like, what if this is Denzel's, this is his real, when he really hits his stride as an actor?
Oh,
what if he just starts going nuts with these Academy Awards?
You know? It'd be pretty cool. I mean, the craziest thing about Denzel Washington, for those listening who only know the Denzel that we talk about on here, like the action Denzel, I mean, even it's funny because even Training Day is still kind of the action Denzel. Like,
yeah.
It's even though that's like a drama. But if you go way back, guys, the first part of Denzel's career, way before Crimson Tide and any of this stuff, if you start counting the movies he was in, like Malcolm X, he gets an Oscar nomination.
Glory.
Cry of Freedom, he gets an Oscar nomination. He wins an Oscar for Glory. I mean, all these old movies, Devil in a Blue Dress, like everything in the 80s into the early 90s, before like his, you know, all the Spike Lee movies he's in, like,
right.
It's just a crazy career. It's like a whole different animal. And, you know, it's the, like those, the late 90s into the 2000s, he becomes this action brand. But like, that guy has a crazy resume of movies that a lot of us have just never seen.
It's so, you know, our discussion with Chris Pine is almost just as good for Denzel, because everyone loves Denzel Washington. There's no one that doesn't like Denzel Washington.
Yeah, agreed.
But is he underrated? Because people, this last 10 years, people look at him and it's like, oh, he's fallen off. But it's like, no, he does Fences. You're like, oh, yeah, that's the guy. Everyone forgets, you know, Glory and all those old things. But what I think that, the other thing I was going to say is box office with all these movies that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Denzel makes not a lot of money.
No,
I mean, okay, well, yeah. Compared to other superstar A-list leading men that have been around for 30 years, his box office numbers are minute compared to like Will Smith, Tom Cruise, like these type of guys.
Yep.
Do you think he's underrated?
You know, I think for the purpose of this conversation, it's better to stick with the other one,
because
I think we would both come to the pretty obvious conclusion that he's underrated. I just think we're I think we're just both such fanboys that all of the things you're suggesting break down to Denzel really just being one of the all-time great actors. I mean, the other thing you have to remember is that, like, it's a black actor we're talking about here. This is not your average, like, your average white actor that sells a movie in a theater. Like, all the movies that we, you know, we cover on the show, we see so much of the same crap. Like, this is a black actor. There's not very many black actors that have the kind of lovability, credibility, box office draw. Like, he is one of the only ones ever.
Yeah, we had the same conversation about a year ago or something when it was like, I don't remember if it was Michael B. Jordan or who, it was like, who's your biggest competition in Hollywood? I don't remember what movie we talked about. He was like, it's Denzel.
Yeah, right.
Denzel's 30 years older than you.
Yeah.
Why is he your biggest competition? Now, over the last year, you've seen with Black Panther coming out and all these other things that are happening, and Fences and Moonlight and Lion, like, it's happening. Finally.
Yeah.
Thank God there's going to be like 20 A-list young African-American actors out there that are getting billed, top billing, that are making millions overseas. Like, thank God we're at that point.
Yeah, it's definitely going in the right direction, but at least in the movie world.
At least in the movie world. So moving on to Chris Pine, the dude gets Star Trek in 2009, he gets Carriers in 2009, and then he does a movie called Small Town Saturday Night in 2010, which is like some stupid small, what, rom action? Something?
I don't know. I mean, what's weird about this is that Chris Pine had been, I think, in The Princess Diaries, is that what it was?
Yeah.
It's like a...
Yeah,
Marissa?
So.
Do you know that? The answer to that question?
The Prince with Anne Hathaway?
Yeah.
One? Yeah, yeah, I think so.
The Princess Diaries? Is that where Chris Pine showed up originally with Anne Hathaway?
Yeah, he was in the second one.
Yeah, that's what it was. So that's like a lot. He had a fan club from that. So Star Trek comes out in 2009, and Abrams wanted to cast relative unknowns, which is why Chris Pine's in that movie. The interesting thing about Carriers is Carriers was shot in 2006.
That's like the kind of horror movie, right?
Yeah, like it's like a virus, like zombie type of movie. It was shot in 2006, and it's not very good, and they sat on it for a few years, and it didn't get released. It got like a tiny release, mostly online.
Yeah.
And they put it out there after Star Trek because now they had some credibility. Unstoppable is the first movie that he did after Star Trek. That's the first movie that came out and had a wide release with Chris Pine in it since after Star Trek was so big. Star Trek was huge.
Oh, it was massive. And it was, the first one is excellent. We covered that on the show.
Yeah. It's great.
Really quickly, because we did ask, a lot of people were saying Safe House was fine. You know, it's good. It's where Denzel's a bad guy. Some people really, really love Two Guns, though, saying it's super badass. But actually, you know what? No, it's going back and forth. A lot of people like Safe House, so maybe it's something you and I need to watch. And then we can come back and do on the show.
And also watch Two Guns, because we love Wahlberg and Denzel.
Yeah.
And if it's like any good, we'll just do it on the show just to do it.
Makes you believe anything he says he does. Denzel is an actor who makes you believe anything he says he does. I completely agree.
Yeah.
Oh, Joel. Joel does not like Denzel. Sorry. You can kick me out of here. I mean, Joel, we love you. He said right here, Grizzled Cruz will be awesome. I know you're on the same page as us. I just can't believe you don't like Denzel.
That's crazy, man.
I think you might be the only person I've ever met that doesn't like Denzel.
He's like the consensus most loved. He's like the most loved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay.
He's Black Paul Newman.
That's right. To each their own. You got your own opinion. So with Chris Pine in 2009 in Star Trek, yeah, we love that. We thought he was perfect as Captain Kirk, right?
Yeah, he's phenomenal. He's so good.
James Tiberius Kirk.
Yeah. So the question becomes with Chris Pine. At this point in his career, we have Chris Pine in a major role in Wonder Woman coming up this year.
Yeah.
He's been in 3 Star Trek movies, a few movies along the way, like This Means War, which Roxy Stryer loves to death.
You know, my buddy Tom, who is, he's like the biggest Tom Hardy fan with me, loves that movie as
This
well.
Means War?
Yeah.
It comes up. I've still never seen it. Roxy's always like, you have to see that movie. It's great.
All right.
I don't believe you.
Maybe one day.
Chris Pine, is he overrated, underrated, or properly rated?
And guys in the live chat, feel free to tweet at us at AMA Podcast. Put it in the live chat. Let us know what you think. Is he over, under, properly? And give us a few words of why you believe that. Where are you at?
Jeez, I feel like at this point it's Chris Pine is underrated. I think he's underrated.
Do you think he should be getting more work?
I think that a couple
or
things.
Different type of work?
I think a couple things happened with Chris Pine. So the biggest movie that he just is in right now is that he has a starring role in Hell or High Water, which just got nominated for Best Picture.
Yes. And I keep hearing from everyone how great that movie
is. Phenomenal. Yeah. Really, really, really good movie. So I think a little bit Chris Pine had the thing happen to him where he kind of came out of nowhere as like a leading man heartthrob, and he was in Star Trek, and I think, because of the nature of Star Trek and how approachable that movie was, and so many kids saw that movie, his brand went in kind of a weird direction.
To try to appease a younger audience, you think?
I just think that his brand went in a weird direction. I think like a movie like Unstoppable is just generic enough to throw the guy in, you know, and this movie had been in development since 2004, so I think the studio was just like, he was just in Star Trek, it was big, let's just film this. Let's just get it made, and we'll put Chris Pine alongside Denzel. That's great. He's a great, you know, leading man to be, you know, a little bit less prominent than Denzel in this movie. And I think after that, the next few years of his career was really just Star Trek stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he has a couple things here and there, like we said, with This Means War, but a lot of what he did was pretty irrelevant or small compared to the Star Trek releases. Now, finally, when things started to slow down and the third Star Trek movie was, you know, like, not exciting anymore. It's not like...
Yeah, it wasn't like the first one or the second one.
The sequel is a big deal.
Yeah.
The third one's kind of like, we're making another Star Trek movie, and you like this Star Trek crew, so go see it. So I think this last year, you know, he was in Finest Hours, which is another, like, that was a big, you know, Casey Affleck and Ben Foster.
I totally forgot he was in that movie.
Yeah, so he's got these, like, sort of a little bit more dramatic art house movies like Hell or High Water coming out, and I think the world isn't seeing him for who he is yet.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, a lot of those really good-looking young guys that get put in a huge role, they just get pigeonholed into that and kill some of their careers, and other people thrive off of it, and I think Chris is one of them.
I think he's a really good actor, and I think the world's going to see more of that soon.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I think that he... It's really tough, man. It's hard to say that the guy that was just in Hell or High Water and the guy that's the lead in Star Trek movies and that has this amazing career ahead of him is underrated. He's in the new Wonder movie, so I think I have to say he's properly rated.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because he is getting chances to do indie art house films and he is being recognized for them whilst hopping on the biggest train there is,
yeah,
which or bandwagon or whatever you want to call it, which is the Marvel movies, and then
DC Wonder Woman
or DC. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't know why I said Marvel. the comic book movies is what I was trying to say. The comic book universe. Yeah, I think he's properly rated, and I think the reason to say that is what I said. He's getting these roles, he's getting appreciated for them, and he hasn't ever done anything where I've been like, God damn it, Chris Pine,
right?
You know, like I just can't watch you in this.
Yeah,
and I haven't seen Small Town Saturday Night. I haven't seen This Means War.
Wasn't he in Smoking Aces, wasn't that him?
Yeah, he's great in Smoking Aces. They're kind of crazy, like a crazy, right? Neo-Nazi, yeah. That's like with his brothers. That's what I wanted to talk about, because you were saying Princess Diaries and I was like, there's another movie that I loved him in. Super cool, because he's not attractive in it. He's crazy. You see a moment of it when he kind of puts on a suit and you're like, huh, that's a really good looking man.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I forgot about that. You know what? Underrated, just for that. Just for bringing up Smoking Aces, he's underrated.
So true story, guys, at the Hell or High Water premiere, this is like a weird thing to bring up, but I gotta say, Chris Pine was dressed in a very strange outfit.
Where are you going with this?
It was kind of weird. Look, this is the outfit that he wore to a red carpet, so it's not like I'm like exposing information here. This is like what he was taking pictures in. But he was wearing these like 70s looking polyester pants that were so tight on his ass.
Oh no.
I mean, it seriously looked like he had thrown basketballs into his pants. I remember I was standing there with another journalist and we kind of looked at each other. And it was a girl, and she like said something, and I was like, thank God you said something about that.
Because you're like, I didn't want to be the only one staring at his ass. It's freaking me out.
And he had like a tucked in, like big collared 70s looking shirt. Really handsome guy, but like I was like, Jesus, like
Who dressed you?
Who put you in those pants? You know, it's like that scene in Superbad when he's like, you fucking shop at Baby Gap, and that's why.
I wish you had a picture of that badly.
I'm sure it is. Probably out there. But
Chris Pine polyester pants.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. So anyway, talking about who made this movie, how it got made. We've talked a lot about Tony Scott already, so we probably will stay away from talking to him about him too much. The one thing we did not mention is that Tony Scott jumped off a bridge on August 19th, 2012, and he was battling crippling depression, and it turned out in the end that he had been battling cancer.
Yeah.
It was originally disputed, but then years later, his brother came out and confirmed it. So,
super sad. He was said to be doing scouting locations for Top Gun 2 while he did it. We don't have it this time in our breakdown, which we usually do, but you guys should go to Wikipedia and read about Tony Scott, because there's an excellent art excerpt in there that a journalist wrote about Tony Scott using Denzel as his muse. And not only is it just written so well, it's very beautifully put, and I think that if you appreciate these films, you will really, really appreciate that little thing that she says.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's great. So the writer on this movie, Mark Baumbach, he's the only writer on this movie, which is really interesting.
Very rare.
Yeah, there's no... He's just like a big Hollywood, has been around. He's in his mid-40s. His breakout movie was that movie Godsend. Do you remember with Greg Kinnear?
Yeah.
And
because I just saw it and I was like, Godsend.
Rebecca Romijn and De Niro is the weird surgeon and they clone their dead son and it's like a creepy movie.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That was the first movie he ever wrote?
And he co-produced
it. Or like his big one? Okay.
That's his breakout. And then the next movie that he does after that is Live Free or Die Hard. He writes the movie.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, which is great. But then you look at a lot of the other stuff, it's like The Wolverine, which is not very good. Total Recall, the reboot, which I heard was terrible.
Not very good.
Unstoppable, like, I don't really know if you would call this a good script. It's just a very generic script. It's it's fine. Like, Insurgent. And then he did the sequel to Planet of the Apes, and he's got the new one that's about to come out, War of the Planet of the Apes.
So
he
there's wrote both Dawn, and there's Rise, and there's War?
Yes.
But he didn't write the first one.
He didn't do the first one.
So good. The second one's still really good.
So he is, like, one of these guys where he is just rock solid.
Yeah.
Been working very consistently, clearly has made great money, has worked on some of the biggest movies, like he just has an understanding of story. If you think about a lot of these movies, it's like a movie like Unstoppable, or a movie like what's the other one
that Live Free or Die Hard is.
Yeah, they're just very, very, very basic scripts.
Yeah.
Like, but it's funny that this is the guy who Godsend was his movie, or Unstoppable, he wrote Unstoppable and had been working on it since like 2002, 2003,
which is crazy that it took him eight-ish years to write that script. And that it's cool, it is very nice when you see that there's only one writer that works on something and that people have the faith in him to not bring in rewrites and not fire. Yeah. You know, so
I also think it's like super interesting when you think about the common age of like a successful screenwriter in his position. If you look, they're very often over 40.
Yeah.
Like they seem to often be in their 40s and 50s. But often, like, their first credit won't have come until, say, like, maybe they were in, like, their late 30s. And what you find out is that a lot of the movies that they write, they've been working on or they've had the script for, like, 10 years.
Yes.
So what I think is interesting is that when a writer gets their first shot and they have a hit, they're like, well, I have these other 7 scripts that I've worked on. Or, you know, I have these 12 other scripts I've written. Maybe you want to look at this one.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the thing that happens.
Or it's like, do a couple for us, and then maybe we'll look at this that you're doing, you know. And our good friend Anthony, who wrote Warrior, we see that a lot with him. And, like, the projects that he's always getting involved with is, like, the dude didn't do anything, really. And then he wrote Warrior. And now the guy is just, he's always writing
all
something
over the place,
new, working on this brand, like, massive franchise, or this new, like, so... For a writer, it's just like anything else in this business. I just think it happens later on.
You just need the break.
You get the break, and then you just go.
Yeah. So, Tony Scott, we mentioned. We talked about him already. He is one of the producers on this movie. Aside from that, I mean, Scott Free Productions, which is the production company he and his brother formed in the 90s, that's the production company behind this. You have a guy named Eric McLeod. Mm-hmm. So he produced Tropic Thunder, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, 2 of the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels. He's kind of like the heaviest hitter on this. Julie Yorn is a little smaller of a producer, but she is a producer on Hell or High Water.
Okay.
So that's an obvious connection there. Mimi Rogers is credited as one of the 5 producers. This is one of 6 credits total she has in the only major feature film. She's an actress. She has 100 acting credits.
I don't know why with Mimi Rogers, I just keep thinking of that chick from the Drew Carey Show. Mm. Wasn't that the big, like, really... You never watched Drew Carey Show?
No.
She like looked like a clown. She was like very large, and I think her name was Mimi. But anytime I look at this name, that's the only thing that pops in my head. Don't know why.
And then last but not least, you have Alex Young, who's just slightly smaller. You know, 6 or 10 credits. Like not a crazy spread of producers on this. You basically had Eric McLeod and then Scott Free Productions, Julie Orne a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, with movies like this, when they don't cost a whole lot of money and they're not expected to win Academy Awards or, you know, become a massive blockbuster success, you find these like large teams of newer producers with like a couple heavy hitters.
Yeah, you get a couple heavy hitters, exactly. So there was a lot with the budget, if you want to jump in on this stuff.
So with the budget, like I was saying, it was not too crazy. It's $100 million, it makes sense. Opened November 12th in 2010. It grossed $81 million domestic and $86 worldwide for a grand total of $167 million. So not great.
No.
You know. And it opening weekend, it was at number 2 at $22 million behind Mega Man in its second week at $29 million. So it no one was really that excited about Unstoppable coming out.
Yeah, the Mega Mind was the movie with Will Ferrell and Brad Pitt, right?
Yeah.
It was like the animated movie.
Yeah, which I also... think wasn't very good, right?
Yeah, it just kind of came and went.
Flops. Yeah,
kind of came and went. Yeah, there was discrepancies with the budgeting on this movie. The original budget was a little closer to 110. They were trying to bring it down to 100, and even Tony Scott wanted to get it down to closer to 90. The studio asked Denzel to take a $4 million discount on his $20 million demand, and Scott to take a $3 million discount on his 9. And I think Denzel dropped out of the project at that point.
Oh, really?
He's like, this is disorganized. I'm not going to do it. And then Tony Scott came back to him within 2 weeks and pitched him on a new idea, and they went ahead and made the movie.
Tony can make it happen. Now this is where I am just blown away.
Yeah.
So this movie was nominated for Academy Award in editing, film editing, but it has a 6.8 on IMDb, and then respectively all top and audience critics on Rotten Tomatoes, all critics give it an 87, top critics give it a 90.
It's so bizarre.
And the audience gives it a 72. Every single one of those numbers is too high.
Yeah.
And 90 is incredible to me.
Yeah.
It seems like a mistake.
It does. I can't really believe top critics would give this movie 90%. I mean,
there's nothing... I mean, it's clean, like you
that's
said.
That's what I said. It's the simplest of all the movies. If Deja Vu succeeds in some ways, it totally fails in other ways, in the sense that the second half is so preposterous and ridiculous.
Yeah, like trying to tell a linear story in that movie as well, whereas this is...
Yeah. People criticize his movies in sometimes for taking themselves too seriously and being overlong. Man on Fire gets criticized for its violence.
Mm-hmm.
Taking Pelham 123 gets criticized for over-dramatizing and just taking away from, like, you know, remaking a much better original. Crimson Tide gets criticized for being kind of, like, too of its time, sort of too much of a Bruckheimer action movie.
Right.
This movie is just, like... simple and good, and the relationships between those two characters, they have a good, solid relationship. Everything is just right. It's like only an hour and 38 minutes, I think.
Yeah, no, it is very, it is clean. And I was like, when they're starting to get up to the train and all that, and I was wondering how much time was left. And there was 20 minutes, and I was like, okay, this is perfect. This is exactly how long this movie needs to be. If it's any longer, it's self-indulgent. I still
disagree.
I still disagree, though. That's just crazy to me. But, hey, I'm down. Just all the more reason to love Denzel and Tony.
Exactly. So let's move on to the next section of the show, guys. This is going to be favorite line.
Yes.
This is pretty simple. It's another one of those ones where favorite line and fist pump are so closely related on this movie for me. But there are some other really good lines in this movie.
So mine is the one that I was mentioning earlier, where it was like, only Denzel could say that. And he's like, now we're going to come from behind, I'm going reverse. And the guy's like, what? He's like, yeah, you know, long hood, lean back. You're like, did you say long hood, lean back to Kevin Dunn as a reason for why you're going to disobey his orders to take this train? Okay. Yeah. Okay, Denzel.
Okay.
All right, then. Long hood, lean back. I love that line. I had to rewind it because it just made me laugh so hard.
It's great. Yeah, I think I like that first... That first interaction about their families when they're in the train, and he's like, "You have any kids?" He's like, "Yeah, I got two beautiful daughters." And he's like, "You know, they're working to put their way through college." Yeah. And he's like, "Where do they work?" "Hooters."
"Hooters."
And they start laughing. He's like, "You're blushing." And he's like, "It's okay. I've heard it before."
Yep.
Yeah. That was like one of those smaller interactions where you're like, on paper. That would just seem simple and funny and doable, and like, and it is, and it made me smile each. I've seen this movie like 6 times, and watching it again, it's like that moment makes you laugh, not because it's like slapstick, but just because like, yeah, in the real life guy, because this is based on a true story. It actually is a real thing that happened. They embellished a little bit, but
yeah, obviously
the guy who Denzel is playing had two daughters, and they worked at Hooters.
Yeah, and it's the type of thing where if you said that, the guy that you just met, would laugh.
Yeah.
If you're like, I got two daughters and they work at Hooters, how do you not, as the guy, be like,
yeah. His two daughters are gorgeous, by the way.
They are very pretty.
Yeah.
And they are cheering like they're watching a game.
Yeah.
For a lot of it. And then they get really sad when they see their dad. So I had a little hard time with that part. They're very, very pretty.
I like that one a lot. I also like, I can't think what his name is in the movie, Denzel, for some reason. I'm like blanking on it.
I can't either. And my phone died.
Yeah. It's like, can you tell me where to find Frank something?
I want
to
say Frank, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Frank.
Garver.
No, yeah, Garver. Right. But Frank Carlin. But I like when Chris Pine first walks up and he's like, can you tell me where to find Frank, whatever? And the guy's like, over there. And he's like, good luck. And you're like, must be a handful because he's Denzel. Even though, like, he's not. Like, why would he say that? Because Denzel is not a dick in this movie.
No, not at all. He's like, very good at his job.
He's really reasonable.
He's really incredibly easy to work with.
Really honest and nice and, like, supportive and, like...
And, like, in the very beginning when they start to, like, go back and forth, he's like, all right. You know, he's the first one to stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
I do really like what you just said, though, about that interaction between them and then, like, on paper, seeing that in a script and just being kind of boring and looked over. That's like why Denzel is so great, is he takes scenes like that and you talk about it on your talk show.
Yeah.
It's like something that would be thrown away anywhere by most other actors, but he has such like a light, levity, playfulness about it.
Yeah.
In delivery, you're like, I want to fucking hang out with you so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just thought that was a cool thing to point out.
He's a top 10 interview for me, man. It's a guy that I'm going to lose it the day I get to interview the guy.
Absolutely.
So we're going to move on to the AMA question of the day. This is from old-time listener Brian Hurst,
yes.
One of our favorites. And the question he had is, will you be playing the SNL parody trailer? Yes. Marissa, can we cue the tape, please?
This is amazing. I'm so happy that you asked this, Brian, and love you, buddy.
It's so good. Have you seen this?
No. Was it. Thanks for watching. Thanks that. For watching. That was good.
Yeah, we probably had it.
You love the Marvel Universe.
Uh-oh.
Avengers, Age of Ultron.
I feel like Captain... This feels like an ad.
We'll restart it.
Dude, the Logan trailer.
Yeah, it looks great.
Oh,
yeah, I can't
God.
Wait. It's funny. This guy, I can't think what the actor's name is who plays Denzel in this, but he's like, there
it's
we go.
So good. All hope rides.
So you're my new partner, huh? I didn't know I was running a daycare center.
Yeah, well, I didn't know I was working at a retirement home, so.
All right.
think that's great.
A man train with 8 freight cars of hazardous chemicals with no air brakes. It's not a train. It's a missile the size of the Chrysler building.
Let's do this, rookie.
Don't call me rookie, old man. I know trains.
Where'd you learn trains, huh? Thomas the Tank Engine?
Yeah, where did you learn trains, old man? From inventing them?
Oh, it's so good.
My man.
Stop that train now.
It gets worse.
It's on a collision course with a train full of kids on a field trip.
It gets worse.
The field trip was to a petroleum refinery, and they all brought home souvenir gasoline. That's enough Fleming kids to hold hands in a circle around the Chrysler building.
What are we gonna do?
Relax, Rugrat. Don't soil your diaper, huh?
Don't soil your Depends, old man.
You see, he's insulting me, and I'm allowing it.
Guys, what's the status?
It seems we're coming to a begrudging respect for each other. When we met, we
begrudging respect for each other.
But now it appears we have more in common than we thought.
Now, what did you want to say?
A nursing home shuttle bus got stuck on the track.
Boom!
There's got to be a way to stop it.
We're trying to figure that out, but we're going through 100 years of files. It's like kind of like, you know, in the Chrysler building.
You're too young.
You're too old.
I love this guy. Okay.
Here's the worst news yet. There was a train on top of the runaway train that's like a Chrysler building on top of a Chrysler building.
Chugga, chugga, choo, choo. Boom.
Good news. We were able to get the runaway on the emergency track.
Where does that go?
42nd Lexington in New York.
That's a Chrysler building.
His Denzel is amazing.
It's really good.
It's so okay. Good. Yeah.
All right, then.
All right.
Okay. I love this guy.
My man.
That's so good.
Oh, thanks, Hurst. Wonderful. Yeah, thanks, Hurst. That was great for bringing that up.
All right, so we will not be ranking or recasting. So which of the three action movie categories does this movie fit into? That's a good one.
Yeah, it's actually a legitimate conversation.
There's three action movie categories, guys. There's totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, ridiculously legitimate. Totally legitimate are movies like The Fugitive and
Terminator 2.
Yeah, they hold together with a lot of drama. They don't really make you laugh unintentionally at any point. Totally ridiculous are movies like Con Air, Face Off, really kind of silly movies that you laugh the whole time, but they're great. We still love them. They're just a little sillier. And then there's ridiculously legitimate, or legitimately ridiculous, as we call it. And movies like The Rock, Point Break, Speed, Predator, they're great. They make you laugh here and there unintentionally, but they're driven by one really strong element, like a great performance or a really compelling plot or maybe just a great script. Yeah. God, this one is really tough.
Yeah, I think I'm going to jump in first, and I think I'm going to say that it's ridiculously legitimate. And I think the reason that I say that is because it's inspired by true events. There aren't really moments other than just like me being in love with Denzel and fanboying out that I kind of laugh unintentionally. It's not totally legit, for sure. Like, I can't just say it's totally legit for me, and I feel like that's where you're leaning. And it makes sense, but for me, I just can't get on board. Like, there's too much stupidness going on, I think, throughout for me to... I don't know, because it's based off true events. I just, like, I keep coming back to this, like, how could this ever happen?
Yeah.
It did.
Kind-ish.
It did. Kinda.
They just embellished a little
bit. Yeah. All right. I'm sticking to it. I'm going middle category, ridiculously legitimate, because I laugh at it unintentionally a couple times, but for the most part, it is a very clean, straightforward movie.
It's ridiculously legitimate. It's not totally legitimate. It's close for me, and I can make an argument for totally legitimate.
What is your argument?
I guess it's that, like, I don't find myself laughing out loud at things in this movie, except for things that I only am doing that because I know what I'm watching. Like, because I know what I'm looking for. Because I love Tony Scott Denzel, so the things that I would want to pay attention for that are part of what they do are so apparent to me when I see them that it's hard for me not to laugh.
Okay.
But I think...
Okay.
I think that this movie is just... It's just simple and done well for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a fucking movie about a runaway train with two guys trying to stop it. It's not a movie. It's not a period piece drama. It's not a movie about a doctor trying to solve cancer.
If they would have put, like, terrorists on the train also that were, you know, that would have made it probably completely ridiculous.
This movie makes me feel like trains are terrorists.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that it is just a train that's runaway and it's very, middle category.
So it's the middle. It's close. But that's that. So then the last category we're going to talk about today is the pitch. So we have a good slate of movies coming up over the next few weeks. We have some guests coming back. But for next week, because 2 weeks from now it's going to be John Wick.
Yes.
John Wick 2.
Can't wait.
Can't wait for that. We had one of our fans, one of you guys, post your wish list.
I can't remember the names. Killian Hegarty, does that sound
nah,
right?
Nah, it wasn't. No, it was it? I tweeted at him.
There was two lists that got posted.
Yeah, and then there was a few other. There was probably like four or five total that got shared with us.
Yeah.
So for anybody watching or listening that if you have listened to or know about the show and have movies that you would love to see that you've wanted to see for a long time, I know there's a few like The Crow.
The Crow is a good one.
Hard Boiled is one that gets thrown out there a lot. We've
the
heard
Raid.
The Raid, Long Kiss Goodnight. There's
Ghost in the Darkness.
Ghost in the Darkness. Yeah, there's some movies that consistently get thrown on less heat. But post your list, guys. Find us on Twitter. At AMA Podcast. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
You can find me at Andrew Guy.
And we will post a reminder for this that in the next 24 hours. And by Friday, we'll put up a poll with what we think are two or three of the best options.
Yep. And then we just need you guys to vote on that.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to do next week. We'll announce the movie on Sunday or Monday so everybody can have a chance to watch before the show next week. Thanks for tuning in for the Unstoppable episode, guys. This has been a blast. Go back and watch all five of the Denzel Tony Scott movies. They're very special to us. And thanks for watching the show today.
Took the words out of my mouth. Take care, guys. Thanks.
Bye, guys.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.